Good morning. Welcome to the first press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, the 7th of January, and I would really like to start this briefing by wishing you all a serene and peaceful new year. I think the most important word is there is peace, and that's really what we wish everyone for this 2025. And let's start immediately and une fois n'est pas coutume, as they say in good English. Let's start with the announcements. I'd like to give the floor to Claire Nullis for WMO. Claire, you're the first of the year. Happy New Year. Go ahead. All right. I know she's there. Just one second to let her connect. I don't know what's happening with that. So let's go to the second announcement. Let's go to Zaina for ILO. So you are the first one, Zaina. Welcome and happy new year. You have an announcement on the upcoming World Employment and Social Outlook Report launch. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning to colleagues and a very happy new year to all of you. Hopefully it'll be a year of peace for everyone. As Alessandro has mentioned, the ILO will be publishing our World Employment and Social Outlook, or WESO, report for 2025 next Thursday, the 16th of January. Now, this report is a flagship report. It comes out on the eve of the World Economic Forum in Davos, and it gives us a detailed analysis of the state of global labor markets, including key trends and challenges. We'll be looking at issues like slowdown in labor market recovery, the persistence of youth unemployment, especially in certain parts of the world, and a widening global jobs gap. We're also going to be looking at how geopolitical tensions, climate change, and income inequalities, economic inequalities, are affecting labor markets worldwide. Now, the report itself and all associated materials will be under strict embargo until the 16th of January at 11:30 a.m. our local time, which is 10:30 GMT. But we will make embargoed copies of the report, a press release, and other materials available ahead of the launch sometime next week, available to accredited and recognized media. And you can obviously contact us via our newsroom at ILO.org in order to request that closer to the date. And for any broadcast coverage or any interviews, including ones that you may want to conduct ahead as you prepare a story, you can also reach us to set those up. Now, in order to do the launch, we're doing this launch rather a little bit differently. We're doing it during a closed door breakfast with our DG, Director General Gilbert F. Humbo. And this breakfast will be held at the ILO on the 16th of January at 9:45 a.m. Now, as I mentioned, this is a closed event, only for UN Palais accredited journalists. We had sent out the invites before the holiday break, and we received a number of confirmations. So thank you very much for those who responded. And just to remind you that if you are planning to attend, we would really appreciate it if you could let us know by COB tomorrow, Wednesday, the 8th of January, so that we can move forward with the planning. Thank you very much. And I do hope that we will get a chance to welcome you all with us at the breakfast on next Thursday, the 16th of January. Thank you very much. Back to you, Alessandra.
Thanks, Zaina. Any question to ILO in the room or online? Lisa Schlein. Good morning, Lisa. Welcome. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you too, and to all everyone else. Yeah, is the press conference going to be recorded? I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it's one thing to have breakfast, it's another thing to record and actually do the work. And if I'm unable to attend, I'm able to get, and other journalists as well, a recording of what happened, or is it possible to do to stream into the event? Thank you.
I think you have to unmute yourself first. Yeah, now you should be on.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you for that, Lisa. So this is a closed door event. It's not a press conference per se, like the traditional one. It's more of a meeting with the DG, who's going to present the findings and who then will be answering questions with the media. And the reason why we are opting out to do it this way is because of the timing. It's ahead of Davos. And it might be an interesting, it is in fact a time to have an interesting conversation as opposed to just a straight out press conference. It won't be live streamed, but as I had mentioned earlier to you, the press release and the report and the executive summary and all the multimedia material will be available to you and all of our UN accredited colleagues ahead of time.
Thank you, Zahina. Any other question? Toyalo? Let me see on the platform, but I don't see any other hand up. Thank you very much, Zeina. So good luck for these appointments, for these events. And let me welcome my first guest of the year in person, Margaret. Welcome. You have an update on respiratory viruses that we have seen circulating also during the holidays. Thank you.
That's right. So it's something that happens every new year, and wishing you all a hopeful and happy new year and a healthy new year. Let's hope we get peace, genuine peace this year. Indeed, there's been considerable media interest in respiratory viruses circulating, particularly in China, and particularly the human metapneumovirus, or HMPV is the shortening in particular. And so I'd like to share what WHO knows about the situation and our advice to the public. So based on what's been reported by the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or better known as the China CDC, in their report of the 2nd January 2025, and that covers data to the 29th of December 2024, but also we've had meetings between WHO and Chinese authorities, there has indeed been a rise in a number of common respiratory infections in the country, and this is entirely expected during the winter. China has a sentinel surveillance system for influenza-like illness and severe respiratory infections. According to the Chinese CDC data, the pathogens causing these infections are known ones, and they include the seasonal influenza virus, the respiratory syncytial virus, also known as RSV, and of course the human metapneumovirus, HMPV. As well as SARS, our old friend SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. Now, among the pathogens reported by China CDC, seasonal influenza is by far the most common that's coming up in all the testing. And it's increasing. The test positivity rate for influenza at the end of December was over 30% among people presenting with the flu-like symptoms in outpatient and emergency department sentinel sites. China's reported levels of respiratory infections are within the normal range. It's what we expect to see for the winter season. Authorities report that hospital utilization is currently actually lower than usual, is currently lower than this time last year, and there have been no emergency declarations. This is really important. There have been no emergency declarations and no emergency responses triggered. So really important, no emergency declarations and no emergency responses triggered. WHO's global influenza surveillance and response system has registered rising trends in influenza in the Northern Hemisphere. So this is across the Northern Hemisphere, where it's currently winter. And so again, this is what we expect. We're seeing this across parts of Asia, Europe, Africa, and a few countries in the Caribbean. Regarding human metapneumovirus, it's not a new virus. So it's got an unusual name, so there's been a lot of interest. But it is not a new virus. It was first identified in 2001. It's been in the human population for a long time. It is a common virus that circulates in winter and spring. It usually causes respiratory symptoms similar to the common cold. It's one of the many viruses, the hundreds of viruses I had to learn as a medical student that cause the common cold. And most of the time they don't make it to the media because they don't cause serious disease illness in humans. They do cause colds, and nobody likes having those. In some cases, like any of the common cold viruses, it can lead to more severe disease in people who've got no immunity or have got very weak immune systems. That's the very young. That's newborn babies. That's why you don't go and visit a newborn baby and kiss it when you've got a cold. And the very old, again, that's why you should not go and visit your over 90 great-grandmother in hospital when you've got a cold. Also, people who are immunosuppressed, so people who are undergoing cancer treatment and other treatments that are weakening their immune system, they can get ill from any virus, including this virus. So our advice to those who are in the winter season is to try to avoid getting ill in the first place. Try to avoid getting infected, always a good idea. And simple measures, as we know, we've all been very well trained by coronavirus, by COVID-19, simple measures can prevent spread. And these include, if you're sick, if you've got symptoms, stay home. We can all now work from home. We can do anything from home. So stay home. No need to come to the office or to visit your friends and share your little present. And also, if you're in crowded or poorly ventilated spaces, when you know that there's a virus currently circulating, think about wearing a mask. Improve ventilation where you can. And, of course, cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue. So if you are out and you're coughing and sneezing, do the bent elbow. Use the tissue. Cough it. Don't share the joy, but it's not joy. So practice regular hand washing. That works for everything. We're seeing norovirus and other gastroviruses rising as well. So regular hand washing is going to protect you from everything. And get the vaccines if you're in a group that is identified as somebody who needs a particular vaccine, a winter vaccine, get those vaccines. And of course, if you're in the highest risk group, older or immunocompromised people, if you do get ill, if you do get a respiratory illness, seek advice. Oh, F1. Sorry, my laptop's making noises. And that's it.
I don't know why I feel a terrible envy of sneezing now.
Sorry, I'll get you a tissue.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Margaret, for this important update. And yeah, it clears up a lot of things that we've seen during the holidays. Let me start with Nina.
I have a question on another.
Let me see if there are questions on the viruses first. I see some of the hands on the platform. So question on the viruses in the room? No. Gabriela, you raised your hand very at the beginning of Margaret's briefing, so maybe you have a question on this. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Happy New Year to all of you. My question is, if you are, how confident are you on the report on China? I mean, it is not a little bit late, or from which date is this report that you are talking about, Margaret? And then this called, I think I have it. So I don't know if it's longer than a common cold. I mean, I have been like 2 weeks with a lot of coughing and, you know, congestion and whatever. I mean, temperature and everything. But I don't know if it's longer than the common cold, if you have any comments on that. And also on pregnant women, because there's no treatment, no? I mean, this is a virus, it's paracetamol or something like that is a treatment, or what are you advising, and especially for pregnant women? Thank you.
Thanks. I'm not sure I should be giving you advice on your own health. I'm not your doctor. But there are a lot of virus circulating. But indeed, if you've got something that persists, go see your doctor and get checked out, Gabby. On the China, yes, as I said, and we'll send these notes, they might have already been sent out to you as well. We indeed have been receiving. The Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention has shared all their data in meetings between WHO and Chinese authorities. And it's also been reported. Their last report was the 2nd of January 2025. And we can send you the link. It's in Chinese, but you've probably got Google Translate. On the third thing, pregnant women are always a vulnerable group for respiratory infections. And that's something that they, if there are various vaccinations, for instance, SAGE recommended late vaccination against RSV in late pregnancy. That was a recommendation we made, I think, last September. And and the influenza vaccine. But again, that's something each pregnant woman should discuss with her doctor. It should be in terms of where she is in her pregnancy and what the situation is.
Thank you very much. Bonjour, Jérémy, bonne année. Tu as la parole.
Bonne année. Thank you so much. I think I also, Gabriela, I also have a call, so this is why I'm not here today again, but let's not transform this this conference into a medical examination, but I'd like some, I could use some advice also. Margaret, I was wondering something really different. China, last week, I think, China said that it shared without any restriction information about COVID. And I'm not sure that we had any response from the WHO since then. So, well, what is your comment on the Chinese reaction?
I'm not sure I completely understood. You're saying that China said that they had been, had there been a full and fair and free provision of all data on COVID-19? Is that what you're asking? And what is our response? Is that your question?
Jeremy, yeah. Can you unmute yourself again?
Yes. I think it's a... It was last week, I think, the Chinese government said that it shared info on COVID without any restriction. This is something that was published on I think, on New Year's Eve, basically. And I'd like to have your comment on that. Do you agree with what China said?
I think if you look at our what we put out on COVID-19 5 years on, our biggest concern, and it's important that this occurs around the world, is more information on the origins and the opportunity to do fuller, in as full as possible, investigation on the origins. So that's the issue that's concerning us.
Nick, Happy New Year. You have the floor.
Yeah, likewise, Happy New Year to you too. And this is also on a different topic, though. So do you want to push me to the back, or do you want to take
I do, it actually. I do, because there are more questions on this virus issue. John Zarkostas, you probably have one of these.
Good morning and Happy New Year to all. Margaret, do you have, perhaps it's in the briefing note, the case mortality rate for the HMPV? And I'm wondering if you're also going to brief on the first death from H5N1 in the US. Thanks.
I don't. The case mortality rate is very, very low. The only group in which you would see mortality are the really, really vulnerable. And you would normally see pneumonia. You would see the more severe respiratory infections. But I don't have an actual case mortality rate. I'll look up in my notes. It might be somewhere. But I, because this is not a pathogen that normally leads to deaths in humans, I think I don't have really clear numbers on that. But I will double check for you, John. You had another question.
First death.
I don't have anything specific on that. Yes, we are aware, indeed, that a man over 65 with, according to reports, underlying illness, and who'd been had some exposure to poultry, has sadly died after a long illness in hospital. But I don't have any more detail for you, John.
I suspect that this was also what Nina wanted to ask you. Just last question to Musa. Musa, you had a question on the previous briefing, or also on another subject, in which case I go to Nina.
Oui, c'est concernant. Donc, John a posé la question que je voulais poser, mais j'aimerais savoir more details about the H5N1 in the United States.
Okay.
One death yesterday, and from many, many days, they announced something in the United States about this virus. Can you tell us more details about that? Thank you.
Sorry. Go ahead, and I'll then ask Margaret to answer.
Thanks. Hi, Margaret. I had a question on that. It was about the death, and if you could say if you think that the U.S. has done enough surveillance or to monitor the cases, and if not, sort of what the risk is for the rest of the world. And then also, in connection with that, how do you see the possible mix between H5N1 and a seasonal flu, and what are the concerns around how those could possibly combine? Thank you.
So thanks. I didn't come with a prepared briefing on the US situation, but indeed they are doing a lot of surveillance. That's why we're hearing about it. They're doing surveillance in the animals. I think you got a comprehensive briefing from our team a couple of weeks ago on exactly that with the World Organization for Animal Health and the Food and Agricultural Organization. And it's critical that it's more than just in the human population, that it very much has to be looked at in the animal population and in the methods we use for farming, for our food production. All those things need to be combined, because indeed it always does pose a risk. As you know, our risk assessment to the general population is still low, and it remains that, and we certainly are receiving information on a regular basis. The risk for a combination of the currently circulating seasonal influenza and the avian influenza is always there. And that's exactly why this work with the animal organization, animal experts, the food production experts is critical, because indeed that's what we're looking for. That's why all eyes are on what's going on, not just in the US, but in the animal populations in other parts of the world as well. And whenever you've got circulating seasonal influenza, and you've got the avian influenza circulating in the animal population, and in sporadic cases, it's not circulating in humans, but it is jumping into humans who are exposed, particularly those exposed to poultry or to the dairy cattle, the two sort of groups where we're seeing most of the movement from animal to human. But we're not seeing sustained circulation. But indeed, it's a time we have to really keep our eyes on, and that's what all the work about pandemic preparedness, human influenza, that's why we have the global influenza surveillance system, and that was set up 20, 30 years ago, and it has been one of the most valuable networks, because it really, really, in real time, gets the numbers, looks at what's going on. But indeed, we all need to do, in the public health sphere, as much work as possible or more, and ensure that we keep up our energy on this.
Go ahead.
Sorry, just a follow-up. There were apparently mutations seen in the man who died, compared to the poultry that he was exposed to. How concerned are you about the possible mutations that could make it easier for this to spread between humans?
So I don't have any information suggesting that that's raised the concern level or risk level, but I'll have to double check on that. You do see mutations. The thing about flu as a virus, the reason why we don't like it is it's really, really good at mutating all the time. So again, you have to see, did it jump from that person to another person easily? How did the virus he's got behave? At the moment, we're not seeing behavior that's changing our risk assessment, but that's exactly why investing in surveillance, being serious about surveillance, being open about data sharing is absolutely critical to the health of us all.
Mr. Liang, and I haven't forgotten Nick and then Gabriella. Mr. Liang.
Thank you, Alexandra. Thank you, Margaret. My question is about the HMPV. Now, we are at the five-year anniversary of the COVID. I think a fair question to ask, without specifying on any country, is could anyone say how much a percentage of our immune system was damaged or destroyed by the COVID? And now we are at the five-year anniversary. Are we still living in the trail of the COVID in a human equivalent of something like a metal fatigue? And would be in a position to say, maybe in the next 5 years, when we are at the 10-year anniversary, we could kind of get out of this metal fatigue. We would be having our immune system kind of restored, or is it possible to have it restored? This is my question. Thank you.
Interesting question. In fact, COVID has trained our immune systems to be very good to responding to it. That's really the two things that got us out of the pandemic was vaccination. That gave us an artificial immune protection, and then our exposure and our experience. So we've all now, most of us, have been exposed at one point or another and carry that immune memory. And that's why it's not making us nearly as sick as it did in 2020, 2021. There are still some people who are at risk. They're older. As I said, the vulnerable groups I mentioned, your newborns, completely innocent of any exposure to anything. So they need to be protected from all viruses. And the elderly, because they've lost their immune memory. And people who've got underlying conditions, because, again, their treatment or their condition has weakened their immune system. But on why do we suddenly seem to respond to other things? Some of it is down to the fact that we're actually better at surveillance. So we're looking for things. My old professor said, if you don't take a temperature, you don't find a fever. We're actually looking for things, so we're seeing things. And as I said, what we look at are the hospitals full? Are they overwhelmed? Are the health workers exhausted saying that they can't? We're not seeing that. So that tells us that, yes, we're seeing more. We're picking up more viruses, but we're not seeing much sicker populations at the moment. There is some discussion around, you know, did we sort of protect our immunity, lose sort of immune memory because we weren't exposed to things for a few years because many of us were in lockdown for so long? There's some discussion about that, but honestly, the jury's still out. The science is still being looked at.
Nick?
Yeah, thank you. And Margaret, just following up colleagues' questions on H5N1, I just wondered, are you seeing a significant trajectory in terms of wider geographic distribution? And where you mentioned that it's heavily concentrated in cattle and poultry. Are you seeing more species emerging as vectors for this virus? Thank you.
It's really a question for my colleagues in the World Organization for Animal Health. I don't have that, but I'm really relying on media reports, but we're certainly seeing reports of other species like the felines. We're seeing cats, we're seeing big cats in other parts of the world, and we are certainly seeing different avian species being affected. But I direct that to the World Organization of Animal Health. They've got fantastic data.
And I wonder whether we could have a follow-up briefing between you and them.
Something soon. Very
that
good
would
idea.
Be really useful, I think, and interesting for everybody. Nick, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, the question was really specifically in relation to the US and whether you're seeing more species in the US, particularly, which are you know, vectors. And this question of also whether the geographic spread of the disease is something that's concerning you. Thank you.
Oh, I see. Well, certainly there are reports of it moving into domestic cats and into the big cats in zoos and others. But again, to get the really specific numbers on that and the detail, I'd really ask you to go to the World Organization for Animal Health. I'm really relying on media reports there. Indeed, we are concerned, of course, but we look at the risk to the general population, and as I said, it still remains low, but we do also are concerned for those who work in the animal industries and advise that for them, some of them could be at higher risk, and they need to be taking the precautions, and they need to be protected by their employees and by their systems and their industries.
Gabriella?
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. My question, Margaret, is on Venezuela. I want to know if you have any contingency plan for Venezuela, because I don't know if you are aware that there's going to be huge demonstrations in Venezuela on the 9th of January, supporting the new president, Edmundo González. So I don't know if you have any contingency plan, because you know the last demonstrations in Venezuela, there was a lot of people injury and they were denied treatment. So I don't know if you have something on that. And if Elizabeth is, Liz is there, if you can talk about Venezuela, how worried are you, Liz, about the threatening of Mr. Maduro, that if Mr. Edmundo González goes to Venezuela, he's going to be detained, like in Russia they did with Navalny, something like that. So what is your comment on that? And if Alessandra has something to say about that, because I know that UN supports democracy. They have been supporting the elections in Venezuela. So Maduro says that he won, but he didn't have any proof. So what are your comments on that? Thank you.
We do have plenty of advice on managing mass gatherings, and we also have plenty of, we provide regular advice and support for trauma management. So indeed, but that would be managed at our country office level.
And Liz, I know you have a lot of other briefings, but maybe you want to answer just this question before we start.
Yes, sure. Thank you, Gabriela, for the question about Venezuela. Well, I mean, obviously, we're following all the human rights developments, including ahead of the planned inauguration and the elections scheduled for this year. With regard to the elections, it's not for us in the UN Human Rights Office to pronounce on the legitimacy or validity of election results. Our concerns, as the High Commissioner told the Human Rights Council last month, are that human rights defenders, members of the opposition and others have been subjected to threats and harassment, that there have been arbitrary detentions. And while there have been initial releases with conditions, we urge the release of all those detained. So we really feel that political negotiations between the different stakeholders are urgently needed to agree on a viable pathway forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I think I'll free Margaret unless there are other questions for her. Thank you so much, Margaret. Yeah, please, both things, if you can send the notes.
Yes.
And maybe think about a follow-up briefing.
Indeed.
With the thank you very much. So let's go to the full briefing of human rights. Liz, thank you very much for being with us. I think you have two points. Want to start with Haiti?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes, I'll actually say good morning now, and I'll repeat the best wishes that have already been expressed for a peaceful, healthy 2025. On Haiti, we are issuing a press release with regard to the number of people killed in gang-related violence. Some 5,601 people were killed in Haiti last year as a result of gang violence, an increase of over 1,000 on the total killings for 2023, according to figures verified by the UN Human Rights Office. A further 2,212 people were injured and 1,494 kidnapped. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk is saying that these figures cannot capture the absolute horrors being perpetrated in Haiti, but they do show the unremitting violence to which people are being subjected. Now, in one of the most deadly and shocking incidents in 2024, at least 207 people were killed in early December in a massacre orchestrated by the leader of the powerful Wolf Jeremy gang in the Cité Soleil area of Port-au-Prince. Many of the victims were older people accused of causing the death of the leader's son through alleged voodoo practices. To erase evidence, gang members mutilated and burned most of the bodies, while other bodies were thrown into the sea. The UN Human Rights Office has documented that there were 315 lynchings of gang members and people allegedly associated with gangs, on some occasions reportedly facilitated by Haitian police officers in 2024. In addition, there were 281 cases of alleged summary executions involving specialised police units between the 1st of January and the 31st of December. The High Commissioner is saying that it's long been clear that impunity for human rights violations and abuses, as well as corruption, remains prevalent in Haiti, constituting one of the main drivers of the multidimensional crisis the country faces, along with entrenched economic and social inequalities. Additional efforts from the authorities with the support of the international community are needed to address these root causes. Restoring the rule of law must be a priority. And to this end, the multinational security support mission in Haiti needs the logistical and financial support it requires to successfully implement its mandate. The National Haitian Police, with the support of the international community, should also strengthen its oversight mechanism to hold accountable police officers reportedly involved in human rights violations. The High Commissioner also restated his call for the full implementation of the Security Council sanctions regime, as well as the arms embargo, crucial to prevent the supply of firearms and ammunition to the country. Weapons flowing into Haiti often end up in the hands of the criminal gangs, with tragic results. Thousands killed, hundreds of thousands displaced, essential infrastructure and services, such as schools and hospitals, disrupted and destroyed. The High Commissioner is saying that the acute insecurity and resulting human rights crisis in the country simply do not allow for the safe, dignified, and sustainable return of Haitians, and yet deportations are continuing. He reiterates his call to all states not to forcibly return anyone to Haiti. Thank you.
Thank you very much for dire numbers. I'll open the floor to questions on Haiti. Don't see any in the room. So, Lisa.
Hi, yeah. Good morning and happy new year to you. What's happened to the Kenyan police forces, to the UN forces that some were sent to Haiti, I believe, some time ago? All has gone quiet on that front. Are they still there? Is there any kind of hope that UN peacekeepers could in some way moderate the awful situation that's occurring in this country?
The multinational support mission, you're right, there are some 400 Kenyan police officers there. There have been some further additions recently. I think there were a number of Guatemalan and Ecuadorian police officers that are being deployed. From our point of view, as we're saying, it's really important that the multinational security support mission, it's got the acronym MSS in Haiti, it does need the logistical and financial support it requires to be successful in implementing its mandate.
Yeah, and the Secretary General also made the same call in December. In fact, a pressing call to member states to provide the multinational security support mission with the financial and logistic support required to successfully assist the Haitian National Police in addressing gang violence. I had seen another question. Moussa, is that, just one second, Moussa, is that on Haiti? Because Lisa's other
no,
things.
No,
okay,
no,
so let's wait on this. Maeva, and then Catherine.
Thank you very much for Maeva Chavez for Kyodo News Japan. Just can you be a bit more precise what the problem there? I mean, everyone was hoping that the Kenyan forces could help to bring peace. And now we are seeing that the number of killed people is even higher than before. So the Kenyans are there. The mission is there. They are trying to help, and they're also lacking funds to stay there. Or you. I hope it's clear enough. I mean, it's just to be a bit more precise. Thank you.
I think with regard to Haiti, given its history, it's actually quite difficult to be precise about what the problem is, because it is a multi-dimensional crisis, as we're saying, that you know, over many, many years. This multinational support mission is in place, but the fact that we are seeing the numbers of people being killed rising, as I said, 5,601 killed this year, that's a rise on 4,450 killed in 2023, and prior to that, in 2022, there were 2,115 killed. Now, these are just stark numbers. Behind every death, obviously, is an individual story, but it just shows the absolute problems that are being faced. That why it is so important that there is international efforts, that there are efforts, as we're saying, that you know the arms flowing into Haiti are stemmed, because the vast majority do end up in the hands of the criminal gangs. You know, Haiti. The island of Hispaniola is an island, so you know these come into the criminal gangs. Guns are not manufactured in Haiti, as it were. So it just underscores the absolute deep-seated problem that is not just a police issue, a security issue, although that is very important, but it involves being tackled on so many levels: political, humanitarian, human rights, economic, of course.
Thank you very much. I see Catherine Fiancon. Is that on Haiti, Catherine? Bonjour.
Yes, good morning. No, all my best wishes for 2025 to both of you. It's a question on Syria, so I can wait if there's there are other questions on Haiti.
Yeah, and also Lisa has another briefing point, but there are many questions on other things, Lisa, I've got also in the chat. Let me just finish with Haiti, if it's possible. Is there any other question on the situation in Haiti? Don't see any. So I have not forgotten Moussa, Catherine, and there was another question somewhere. Riano Vossi, Yuri. But before giving you the floor for those, I'd like to let Liz brief us on the second point on her agenda, which is Iran and the rise in executions.
Yes, we're deeply troubled by the marked increase in executions in Iran last year. At least 901 people were reportedly executed in 2024, including some 40 in 1 week alone in December. At least 853 people were executed the previous year in 2023. Most of the executions last year were for drug-related offences, but dissidents and people connected to the 2022 protests were also executed. There was also a rise in the number of women executed. It's high time that Iran stemmed this ever-swelling tide of executions. We oppose the death penalty under all circumstances. It's incompatible with the fundamental right to life and raises the unacceptable risk of executing innocent people. And to be clear, it can never be imposed for conduct that is protected under international human rights law. The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk urges the Iranian authorities to halt all further executions and to place a moratorium on the use of the death penalty with a view to ultimately abolishing it. Some 170 states have either abolished the death penalty or imposed a moratorium on its use. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz. Question on this? I see, Emma, and then Nina.
Good morning, Liz. A question on the data and also the methods of execution. How long have you been monitoring the annual executions, and when was the last time it was so high, or maybe is this the highest ever? Also, could you detail how many women were killed versus previous years? And secondly, could you comment on how these people were executed, and did they suffer greatly? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Emma. I'll try to address all your points. Obviously, remind me if I've forgotten one. I think, first of all, let's just take a step back. Clearly, it is hard to get information from Iran. Part of the problem is, of course, the lack of transparency around executions in the country. So that's the starting point. We do have figures from different human rights organisations, ones that we consider reputable, the Harana, Hengo, and the Iran human rights organisations. On women, I think you asked, the number executed. We understand that at least 31 women were reportedly executed in 2024. Now, that marks the highest number in 15 years. Okay. The majority of cases involved charges of murder. A significant number of the women were victims of domestic violence, child marriage, or forced marriage. A number of them were convicted of murdering their husbands, we understand. The number of executions overall, we are concerned about this rising tide. I'm just looking back at the information I have. In 2015, Iran executed at least 972 people, and that marked the highest number of executions in recent decades. But as we were saying, it's 901 in 2024. Our office has been monitoring Iran overall, but also executions in Iran for a number of years. And what we've seen is that you may recall that in 2017, there was a reform of the anti-narcotics law, because a lot of the people executed are executed for drugs offences. So we did see a notable decrease in executions. However, what we've seen is that since 2022, the numbers have risen sharply. And as I said, in 2024, we had over 901. Now, the method of execution, we understand that is by hanging.
Nina?
Yeah, hi, Liz. My question was also about, I guess, the sources when you say reportedly. But could you say how confident you are that the number is around 901? Do you think that it actually could be higher, or how much insight do you actually have? Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's a pertinent question, I think, precisely given the lack of official data. So we do have to rely on organisations that we've worked with over a number of years that we've received information from. So I think what we're looking at is we're liaising with the organisations, we're getting the information, we're trying to take a sort of a considered view of the numbers we're being given. So really hard to say whether we think the number could be even higher, but we are confident of the number, because obviously we're going public saying that we're concerned about these numbers. Yeah.
Let me go to the platform. I think Nick has added his hand. Is that on Iran?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Liz, I just wondered if you had an estimate of, or you knew how many of the executed people were convicted on specifically political offences. And secondly, in relation to this week where 40 people were executed in 1 week, I mean, is that associated with one particular prison? Are we talking about multiple hangings being carried out on the same day? Or is this, what further detail can you provide about this?
Yeah, Nick, let me start with your last question. The 40 in 1 week, I'd need to check back with colleagues specifically whether it's 40 in one prison or 40 overall. So we'll try and get more information on that. Convicted of political offences, again, I think it's difficult to establish the numbers. We are saying that we believe the majority are for drug-related offences. We do know that there have been a number of people connected, considered political dissidents, involved in the protests. We don't have overall numbers. What we do have, we're aware of some emblematic cases. So, for example, in January last year, there was Mohammed Gobadilou. He was executed for what was termed waging war against God, a murder accused of running over police officers during the Maha Amini protests. There are a number of other sort of named individuals that we know have been executed. But again, I'd need to double check on whether we have numbers on those convicted political offences. I think that we probably don't have concrete numbers on that, but we do know that there are a number of people who have been sentenced. They haven't yet been executed, but that have been sentenced with regard to political what term political offences.
Gabriela, is this on Iran?
Yes, on Iran, and then another question on another subject. My question is, what are the consequences for Iran in the UN system? I mean, human rights, are there any, I don't know what measure can the UN do with Iran, with a country like that? I mean, maybe are they going to be part for the Human Rights Council, or they can't? Something that your office can do to reprint, or I don't know how to say it in English, a country like that.
I think it's clear. Know? It's clear enough, Gabriela. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, okay. Liz.
Well, I think the point is, that we, the UN Human Rights Office, but other human rights mechanisms, we monitor and we advocate and we speak out with regard to Iran or on the question of executions. What we always say is that all states are bound by their international human rights obligations, and as I'm sure you're aware, that for example, Iran is party to a number of international human rights treaties, so is reviewed by the treaty bodies, for example. It's this constant highlighting, calling for the death penalty to stop, and it's not just the death penalty in Iran. It's overall, as I said, we're opposed to the death penalty, and we've repeatedly called for its halt. We've repeatedly called for a moratorium. So it's not a question of us being able to waive specific sanctions, but what we have done over many years, and what we will continue to do, is to highlight the executions being carried out in Iran, and we will continue to call for a halt.
Indeed. Lisa, I see your hand. Is that on Iran, on a follow-up on this? And then I'll go to the others.
Yes, hi. Yeah, Liz, just very quickly, did you say that this is the highest number of people that Iran has executed, as far as you know, if you could affirm that? And also, what sort of recourse, if any, do people who are arrested and convicted of these serious crimes have in terms of appeals? Do they have access to lawyers? Is there any sense of fairness in the judicial process or not?
Lisa, with regard to the highest number, what we have noted is that since 2022, the number has been rising again. We know that in 2015, at least 972 individuals were executed. So we believe that this is the highest number in recent decades. But clearly, the number for 2024 is alarmingly, shockingly high at least 901. With regard to the judicial system in Iran, to the recourse that people have, well, again, as I said in response to other questions, part of the problem is the lack of official data. It's the opacity of the system. I mean, people will have lawyers, but of course it's very hard to determine how free and fair a particular trial may be. So I think this is why we believe it is so important to be speaking out,
on the executions, but also highlighting that there are people who are awaiting execution, who are on death row, who have been charged. So with regard to the actual judicial system, I don't have too many details, but we are concerned because there is the lack of transparency around what happens in Iran with regard to the sentencing and the carrying out of the death penalty.
Thank you, Liz. I've got four people who have questions for you on other subjects. I'll start with Musa, then Catherine, Yuri, and Gabriella. Musa, you have a question on Syria for Katrina, for Liz, sorry.
Yeah, thank you. We have seen many videos about violations against people in the streets in Damas, Homs, especially Homs, and Latakia and other cities. Especially against the Alawit minority. Do you have another subject, if you have some details about that, and if you have any idea about the number of detainees since the fall of Bashar al-Assad regime? Thank you.
I didn't catch the last bit. The number of...
Okay. Detainees, the number of detainees since December 8th. Thank you. Okay. With the new regime.
Yeah, I don't have numbers on the detainees. With regard to what you were referring to is the reports and the videos that have been seen with regard to the Alawites. We are aware of the reports, and obviously our colleagues are working to corroborate. We note that the authorities have issued a statement calling on all to avoid retaliation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And sorry, and maybe just we're speaking on Syria. Jennifer asked me to inform you that the UN Special Envoy for Syria will brief the Security Council on this Wednesday, tomorrow at 10 a.m. New York Times, 4 p.m. Geneva. It's a brief. It's an open briefing, so you can listen to it on the UN Web TV, and the remarks of the Special Envoy will be circulated when he finishes, as usual. Now I have Catherine on a question. I don't know on which subject is it. Catherine, go ahead.
Thank you, Alessandra. It's also on Syria. In fact, it was it's a follow-up on the question asked by my colleague. A lot of Syrians that are living abroad are reporting about the killing of men in Homs and in the cities around. They're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 Alawite men that have been killed the last weeks. They're also speaking about women being beaten up because they are talking or walking in the street with men that are not their husband, brothers, or father. And also beating up and killing people that are not going to the Friday pray. So I'd like to know how human rights is monitoring those allegations, and if you have already had the opportunity to exchange with the authorities, HTS authorities, about the respect of the rights of women and religious minorities. We've seen recently that the head of HTS refused to shake hands with the minister of vice minister of the foreign affairs of Germany. I'd like to know more about your position on that and the kind of channel that you have in order to monitor and to exchange on those topics with the new authorities of Syria. Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. We have had initial contacts with the caretaker authorities in Damascus at the technical level. We've been engaging with obviously with other UN actors and diplomatic community as well. So this, you know, as you know, our office has been monitoring Syria for many years remotely because we weren't allowed in the country. So, you know, we have, you know, been involved in human rights monitoring and protection advocacy. We have close links with civil society actors and victims. So you know, this work is ongoing and is continuing because it's really important. With regard to the specific reports, I replied on the issue of you know, videos emerging from Homs and things like that. I mean, I think what it is really important is that all parties abide by their obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and that includes the respect and protection of minorities. It's really important that all measures are taken to avoid sort of behaviour conduct that is driven by the desire for revenge. We've said this before, but it basically bears repeating that human rights must be central to an inclusive transition if Syria is to come to terms with its past and construct a society in which the rights of everyone will be respected, protected and fulfilled, irrespective of you know, their gender, their ethnic or religious community, age or ability. We really believe that it's important that you know, the caretaker authorities, you know, must act to ensure that security is restored, that those accused of committing crimes are held accountable, and that women, children, and diverse ethnic and religious communities can fully exercise their rights. So I think that sort of speaks to your question specifically about women, Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Liz. It's on that? No, it's just like to take the opportunity to inform you that we have a newcomer and we welcome her in the Geneva Communication Community, Nermin Abdelhamid. Nermin is the new press person for the Independent Institution of Missing Persons in Syria. And we have given her your contacts and we'll give you her contacts so that if there are questions on the issue of the missing person in Syria, you can contact her, and I hope she'll be coming to the briefing soon. If it's another subject, Nina, wait a second, because I have Yuri has been waiting with this question in writing. Lisa, I will read it to you, and I think he has a problem with the mic. So Yuri is asking you something about Ukraine and Russia. He says, Saturday, several kilometers from the front line on the road between Donetsk and Gerlovka, a Ukrainian drone hit the civilian vehicle of five journalists from different Russian media. The correspondent of the newspaper Izvestia, Alexander Martemanov, was killed, and four other journalists were injured, including the correspondent of Lenovosti. Is your office aware of this situation? Can you comment on it? Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Yuri. We are aware of the reports regarding the reported killing of the journalists. We don't have specific information to be able to comment directly on this incident, but obviously we would always repeat the importance that you know, journalists enjoy specific protection and should be allowed to go about their work, you know, without fearing for their lives or being prevented from doing their work. If I may just also highlight that tomorrow, the Deputy High Commissioner Nada Al-Nashif will be presenting an update, a statement on Ukraine at the Human Rights Council. So that's tomorrow, and I think it's at 3 p.m. if memory serves me correctly. Thank you.
Yeah, just speaking on that, let me inform you, Pascal has asked us to read this to you, that the Human Rights Council convenes at 10 a.m. in Room 20 tomorrow, Wednesday, 8th of January, for the selection by lot of the UPR Troikas, which is the sets of the three states which act as rapporteur in the UPR process. And in the afternoon from 3 p.m., the Council will hold an interactive dialogue on the oral update by the High Commissioner on the findings of the OHCHR report on the situation of human rights in Ukraine. This is the meeting that was postponed, you may remember, from the end of last year. The Deputy High Commissioner, Nada Al-Shahif, will present the Ukraine report to the Council. The report was published on the 31st of December and can be found on the website of OHCHR. And of course, you can contact Pascal and his team if you have any if you want any more information on this. On this meeting on Ukraine, and obviously this will be the first meeting under the chairmanship of Switzerland, the presidency of Switzerland. Okay, now I'm lost because there are so many other hands. I hope they are not on this subject. I'll go one by one. After Yuri, we said Gabriela.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. it would be nice if Carla Quintana, the one representing disappearing persons in Syria, mm-hmm. could give us a conference or something like that. I mean, a press conference would be nice. I don't know if she's going to be based in Geneva or mm-hmm. in New York or where she's going to be, but it would be very nice to have her here in press corps, with the press corps. I'm so sorry, but coming back on Venezuela, the Organization of American States, they already validate the elections in Venezuela. So I don't want you to talk about elections, but if you, Liz, can give us what are the obligations of a state when huge demonstrations are in the streets? Because there's going to be huge demonstrations in Venezuela tomorrow. And we remember that last time people were killed, targeted and killed in demonstrations in Venezuela. So if you can say something on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Gabriela, thank you very much. On your question about Mrs. Quintana, I'll ask Nermin to look into it, and maybe that will be the occasion for her to introduce herself to you. And on the Venezuela question, Liz?
Yes. Well, the obligations of Venezuela are the obligations of any state. It's international obligation to abide by the right to peaceful assembly, to ensure that people can exercise their right to freedom of expression and association. And of course, the stress as well, of course, is that it's peaceful assembly. So that is something that we would definitely reiterate. Thank you,
Nina.
Yeah. Sorry, on another subject, I was wondering how concerned your office is about the fact that you have billionaires like Elon Musk who are clearly meddling in European political systems when it comes to to democratic rights in those countries. Thank you.
Well, I mean, obviously, we're seeing, what is being said, what is being expressed, and we're also aware that shall we say, politicians that are maybe, being attacked are well able to respond for themselves. Thank you.
John?
Yes, good morning. Happy New Year, Liz. I've got a general question. I was wondering if the Office of the High Commissioner or any of the special thematic rapporteurs have made any comment on the decision by the interim authorities in Syria to suspend the constitution. That does not absolve them of their responsibilities under international humanitarian law, correct?
They are bound by international humanitarian law and international human rights law, indeed.
Moussa?
Oui, merci beaucoup. In Syria again, my question is very, very specific, please. Do you have your own information regarding the violations in Syria today? And I don't understand if you have your own team in Syria, and if this is the case, the team work normally? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Musa. As I said earlier, our office has long experience in working on Syria, not working in Syria, but working on Syria, playing a leading role in human rights monitoring, building up relationship with civil society, producing reports, getting information, monitoring. That work continues. Now, obviously, there's been this seismic change in Syria, so that we did deploy a small team of four people to Syria to start engaging on the ground on human rights issues. Really, because we know that this is such a crucial moment in Syria's history. And as I said earlier, that human rights will be central to any just, peaceful transition for the country. So, yes, we are working, we're monitoring. That work continues. The expertise that we've accumulated over the years is being continued to be put to use. We have some colleagues on the ground, so that is really vital to start getting direct information, building contacts with people, building relationships, and seeing what we are able to contribute with regard to human rights protection and promotion in Syria.
Thank you very much, Liz. I think we can let you go, but before we close completely the human rights issue, Just let me remind you that on Monday, the Committee on the Rights of the Child opens its first session of 2025, which is actually their 98th session. Until the 31st of January, they will be meeting in Palais Wilson and reviewing the reports of Slovakia, Eritrea, Honduras, St. Kitts and Nevis, Peru, Gambia, and Ecuador. And in the afternoon of Thursday, the 30th of January, the committee will also have a meeting with states. We remind you the countries as long as we, in the course of the month of January. I think we really told you everything we had on human rights issues. So Satoko, is that for Liz before I let her go? Happy New Year. You have the floor. We can't hear you, Satoko. You have to unmute yourself. It's strange. I can see you are on, but we can't hear you. Sorry. Let's try again. Let's try now. I see you're on the platform. I'm sorry, Satoko. We can't hear you. Maybe you can jot down the question, and I'll send it to Liz. And maybe if it's in a minute, you can still be on. So let me go that's your question, Satoko. That's very good because it's not for Liz, but she's asking what happened to WMO. WMO is online. I see Claire on the screen. So let's give her the floor as the last briefer of the morning. Good morning, Claire. Happy New Year. You have got the floor.
Yeah, happy New Year, everybody. Yes, WMO is definitely still here, and it's our 75th anniversary this year. So you'll be hearing lots about that. On Friday, the World Meteorological Organization will be issuing a press release on the temperature, the global temperature in 2024. There's obviously been, a lot of coverage of this already, that, we do expect it to be the warmest year on record. So what we are doing on Friday is to sort of crunch the numbers together and come up with a consolidated global figure. WMO uses 6 individual data sets, one from NASA, one from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, one from the UK's Met Office, one from Berkeley Earth, one from the Japan Meteorological Agency, and one from EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Each of these data sets will have their own individual figures, findings, and each I think will be released separately on Thursday, on Friday. And so what we will then do is just consolidate them all and get one consolidated global figure, which then goes, you know, forward to the UN Convention on Climate Change for the COP negotiations, et cetera. The timing of this, we have to coordinate with all the other data set producers, so we won't be able to send it much under embargo simply because we'll be waiting for the last figures. We will be trying to time it to coincide with the release of the NASA and NOAA data, which unfortunately for you is 5 p.m. Friday afternoon Geneva time. If we can send it out under embargo ahead of that time, we will do so. Will be a press release. We won't be able to send it much ahead of time just because, you know, we're waiting for the numbers. In addition to the global temperature ranking, this year we're also coordinating with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which oversees a global consortium which will be producing a paper on sea surface temperatures and ocean heat content. So this will be a study from them rather than WMO, but we will, you know, we will also be talking about it in the press release and sending you a link to that very important study. That's the temperatures. This year marks the International Year of the Preservation of Glaciers. It's a year which the WMO is co-facilitating along with UNESCO. The actual launch event of that will be the Tuesday the 21st of January. There will be an event at WMO in the afternoon. To set the scene for that, we are having a background virtual briefing with, you know, everybody from all journalists and all over the world will be invited. And that is taking place on Wednesday, the 16th of January. It's in the afternoon, so it won't clash with the ILO breakfast briefing. You will be getting more details of that along with a Zoom link, and my colleague Brigitte Perrin is dealing with that. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Claire, for this announcement. Any questions to WMO in the room or online? No, I don't see any. So thank you very much. Good start of the year with all this information. I just wanted to wrap up with an announcement on our side to inform you that we will be sending you tomorrow the UN World Economic Situation and Prospects Report for 2025, along with an accompanying press release. This is the report. The report and the press release are under strict embargo until 6:30 Thursday, 9th of January, which is actually noon 12:30 New York time, marking the time of the global launch of the flagship report. As you know, the report is launched in New York and has several accompanying regional launches. The report is produced by the Department of Economic and Social Affairs of the UN and presents the global and regional economic outlooks for 2025, addressing the latest global trends and regional economic forecasts, and underscores the importance of global cooperation to lift growth. We'll send you the material around noon tomorrow, and we will also send you a list of experts available for interviews. Normally we have a press conference around this report, but this year unfortunately it was not possible to organize it, but there will be experts who will be available for interviews in English, French and Spanish, among other languages. Rolando is following this launch for UNIS, so if you have any question for him on this, don't hesitate to ask. And I just wanted to give you a good, nice information that starting from, I think, from today, if not the end of this week, the Bar de Delegue is reopening. So you, if you want to go and have a coffee after the press briefing, which we probably all need, just go up 3 floors and we'll find our Salon Suisse open again. I'm not sure about the date, but I think it's this week. Monday, the coming Monday. Great, thank you very much. So thanks to everyone. Oh, John, you have a question? Is that for me?
Yes, good morning, Alexandra, again. I was wondering if there's any statement or decision on the appointment or renewal of the Director General of UNOG. Thank you.
No, John, not for the moment. If we have anything to share, of course, we will do it immediately, but not for the moment. Thank you. Anyone else? No, no hands up. So thank you very much for following this first briefing of the year. We made it in almost 1 hour and 20 minutes. And we'll see you on Friday. And again, Happy New Year to everyone. Thank you.